Good afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. With this recording, we are recording 242, so that's episode 242. And today is Friday, so happy Friday to everybody. This podcast is the only thing standing between you and a cold beer somewhere, and hopefully it's sunshine where you are. Today is the 19th of June, 2026, and we are going to be having a very interesting conversation. Actually, I've been waiting for this one. Both my guests and I attended a conference not too long ago. That's the World Speak Conference, for hosted by CLIA. That's the brand we use in Canada, World Speak, for our annual conference. And what we thought we'd do, we said we'd do a recap on this. So it's pretty interesting to for two attendees or very involved. I was heading a panel. Carla, my guest here, will let her introduce herself in a second. I just don't want to take her thunder. She also headed a panel, organized a panel discussion as well. And what we are going to do today is we're going to compare notes, tell you what we think, what worked, what could be improved, and maybe comment on the general direction of the industry as we go along here. So without any further ado, allow me to welcome our guest of honor today for our conversation, Carla Itzkowicz. And Carla, welcome to the conversation. Glad to have you.
Thanks so much, Robin, and a great introduction. We had fun at the CLIA, even though it was a virtual event. And I really enjoyed chatting with you also at the Global Sake event. And we had commented at the Global Sake that it was really nice to be at these smaller kind of events in person, right? Because the industry has changed so much in terms of events and everything. And right at that time, they announced that the CLIA World Speak was going to go virtual. So it was a big shock to everyone. But in the end, I think it worked really, really well. And it talks a little bit about how, you know, the lock lunch or the smaller events might actually be a more human touch. And then the bigger events get a bigger audience when they're virtual. What do you think?
So, you know, I didn't see anything wrong with going virtual. In fact, it was more effective for all of us. I mean, you were able to communicate, you were able to see, with the exception, of course, the human touch. We're all human at the end of the day. They want to see each other face to face. You can't take that away.
But well, let's hope it doesn't replace it completely, right? But I mean, for me, the one thing is that because I was still in California and not in beautiful Gatineau, I ended up, you know, either getting up at 5 a.m. or missing the opening remarks. So that's the only thing.
100%. So yeah, managing time zones, specifically when you want to go global with these things, could be a problem when you go virtual, because when you put them all in one room, they're under the same time zone. But when you have all your audience distributed around various time zones, it's pretty hard to control.
At the same time, you get a bigger public, so that's kind of nice. And you have all the recordings, which a lot of live events are not providing, and not to mention the cost, right?
Carla, not all people like that listen to this channel knows you. So let me start with this one.
Sorry, I forgot I took off running.
No, that's fine. That's okay. I mean, this is what this is about. We're having a conversation. I'm not a journalist, so I'm not interviewing people. I'm just having a conversation with people. So Why don't we do this? The first thing is people are asking right now as they listen to you and me talking here is, who is Carla?
So and where did I come from?
We'll start with the easy one for you. What's your story? What got you here?
So I started in translation back in 1982. I was young and brash and brave. And so I decided that I could start a company because I was from Mexico and I was living in the land of possibility where there was a lot of support for minority women. And in those days, getting into the industry wasn't a big burden, right? You needed a computer and some gumption and the ability to sell. And I actually started out in video production. I had a show called Eye Contact California that if I had stuck with it, maybe I would have the Home Shopping Network. But instead of doing that, people asked me to translate their videos into Spanish because I'm from Mexico. And my partner, my mom at the time, she was a personality on Univision. And so we started this company making videos, and it was like a evening magazine type video. And then we started translating commercials. And at the time, there wasn't very much. So we were just doing video, but people kept saying, well, we have this wraparound with the video. We have a print ad, or we have the cover of the video that we need to translate. And we gave it to the manicurist. And so they would bring it to me and I would say, this is terrible. And then finally, one day we got tired of saying, this is terrible. And, or the gardener had translated it for them, right? And So we decided that we were going to get into print translation. And then one thing led to another over 40 years of owning International Contact. And by the end, we did all media, all languages, and we were a one-stop shop for language companies. Halfway through the trail, I realized that there was an association of language companies, that the whole industry had grown up around me, and that it was now billions of dollars, right? So then my dad got sick. Circa 2016 or thereabouts. And I wasn't very much at the office, so I started looking around to sell my company. And I think every owner has a number. Now that I know about mergers and acquisitions, I really think. And I had a number. My number was just, it needed to be millions. It couldn't just be millions. So when I first started selling it, I couldn't get millions for it. So I kept working on growing it and delegating and doing all the things that owners need to do in order to sell for a better price. And lo and behold, circa 2022, I was able to sell it at just about 40 years into it. And by then, I had started doing these webinars for the Association of Language Companies where I was interviewing other sellers. We were all very small at the time in terms of mergers and acquisition consultants, but since then the field has grown significantly, and a lot of companies, I just found out in the Association of Language Companies survey that about 10% of companies are growing by acquisition. So it's not just about selling your company, but also about growing, about being prepared. And I just love the pivot that I made because I get to stay in the language industry that I love so much, help my peers and people that I've known for a long time, but do something a little bit different.
You know, every business, it doesn't matter what business, unless you have certain plans for it, but every business needs to find a way to exit, to either sell, etc. Unless you planning on inheriting the thing to your family members, etc. I mean, what would be the purpose of building a business if it's not to cash some value out of it?
But so many of us just start with one foot in front of the other, right? I didn't go to business school. I just started and I got lucky. Luck is definitely a big part of it. But having an exit plan, even if you're not exiting right away, allows you to know where you're going. And in fact, just yesterday, I talked to a potential client whose kids do not want his agency, right? Mm-hmm. So very often, or a lot of us don't have kids anymore, right? So if you don't have an exit strategy, you're going to end up just closing. And in fact, one of the statistics that left me stunned right away in this business is that about 50% of businesses just close, right? Only 50%, 40-50% of business owners have the wherewithal to sell their client list, to sell their assets. I mean, there are many ways to skin the cat and every deal is different. But if you don't have an exit strategy, you're definitely behind the eight ball.
Correct. Now, a very interesting, conversation we're having regarding these companies that they're growing by acquisition, Carla. As the audience would know, I mean, for those of you who are familiar with the sales process and how to grow a company, there's two ways to grow a company. You can either get it organically, meaning get sales organically by hiring salespeople, or you do it yourself if you want to. I don't recommend it, to go out and get some customers. And the second thing you can do, you can just buy revenue, buy another company in the same domain or domain you aspire to be in, and then bolt that revenue onto your business. Now, the part that really interesting that Carla talks about is about 10% are trying to grow by acquisition. That tells you that either the well is dry on the organic side and people are trying to figure
out. Well, it's just so expensive is what they tell me, right? It's that, building a sales team, going out for RFPs, doing all of that work, marketing and all of that kind of stuff is very expensive. And given the status of the industry right now with a lot of turmoil with AI and all that kind of stuff, acquiring a company that can grow your verticals, that can maybe take out a competitor. I mean, there are many motivations for why somebody would want to grow through acquisition. And so people are starting to recognize that. And the other thing is that I like to talk about is that the mergers part of mergers and acquisition, you don't need to be a big investor in order to buy a company, right? You can form alliances and merge in some very creative ways that we're seeing these days that allow for rapid growth. If you want to grow quickly, acquisitions or mergers are a good area to look into for sure.
Absolutely. Now, going back to the CLIA conversation, the CLIA conference that we've had, One of the, I don't know if you recall the opening session by, I think it was Renato who gave
that. Yes.
Yeah. And he framed the talk around the LSPs are no longer to sell translation, but perhaps sell peace of mind. He also pointed to M&A as a forward growth strategy, not an exit plan necessarily, unless you want to exit. What did you think of that conversation?
Renato is always talking on the abundance side, right? Which is why we love him as a keynote speaker, right? I mean, he's always saying that the amount of words that were being translated 20 years ago pales in comparison to the words that are being translated today. And that by lowering the threshold of cost and allowing AI to take care of certain things, you're growing the whole pie. And so people who were never even thinking about localizing before are completely into it now, not only because it's a worldwide market, but because the cost is going down, right? And so what Renato said that I like very much is that language companies no longer sell translation. What they sell is peace of mind. And that reminded me, because I started in marketing and marketing translation of a campaign, I think it was maybe 45 years ago already when I first started, that was like sleep better at night, right? People at the time, people were barely thinking of localizing their media, right? And yet it was a very, very fertile ground, but they were very scared because they didn't understand and they didn't know. And so the idea that you're going to take them by the hand and you're going to take care of them and grow their market instead of selling them their translation that they already realize that they need is somewhat revolutionary in that it's taken hold. But I mean, I heard Renato say this kind of stuff back, you know, 20 years ago, but it's getting, you know, it's like a snowball, and I tend to agree with him. And it was a great session because a lot of really good energy and made people happy to still be in this industry, I think.
So you still believe in the, I had that separate question for you. You still believe that Sleep Better at Night campaign works now or no?
I think it does, you know, because the amount of HCHD and nervousness and people just not even knowing where to turn and just being able to confidently know that you're going to enter a foreign market. I mean, I can imagine that for marketing managers, that fear never goes away, right? Because they're putting out something blind.
And that entire peace of mind, just for the audience, so let me dig a little deeper into so you understand what we're talking about here. So for those of you who are not from the industry looking from the outside in, you may hear this thing and you may think, you know, I've got to buy an alarm or something. No, we're not buying alarms. What we're talking about is in the age where people are using lots of technology, lots of tools, relying on a lot of automation. And you've heard me speak on this channel before about determining the value, assessing where are our value we bring in. What's our expertise that we bring into the new game now as professionals? The Sleep Better at Night reframing here means that the professionals in the industry becomes the safety net that the businesses needs in order for them to feel that they are going to be delivered a very solid content, that they are peace of mind. They have a peace of mind putting it in front of their market, in front of their customers, in front of their audience without getting embarrassed. Let me give you an example. You don't want to do what HSBC did in Canada on the highway in Montreal. Okay. Last, not this soccer round in 2020, they do them every 4 years, right? So in 2022, there was a huge billboard on the, on Highway 20 in Montreal, just going into the city, you know, around the word goat, you know, greatest of all time.
Time, right.
And that word was translated into an actual goat right on the billboard. So you don't want to do that. That's the point I was trying to make here. So peace of mind, meaning use the professional and intellectual capacity of this industry to give you a bit of a safety net, whatever you want to call it, security measure, whatever you want to call it, between the automation, the tools, the technology, the robots you're using, and the delivery entities that you're trying to aim for this content, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And along with that campaign, we had another ad that was don't get pregnant with your clients because, you know, in Spanish, embarazado means pregnant. And very often that miscognate gets translated to don't be embarrassed, no estés embarazado, which means pregnant. So the campaign was don't get your clients pregnant. So yes, speaking another language when you don't speak another language and entering that market confidently must make the C-suite very nervous. If it doesn't, it should. And having a trusted partner who's not going to let the AI turn your goat into a physical goat is probably a good idea. So, I mean, Renata knows this, and we do have evidence that the growth of the market is growing, even though the cost to translate is lowering.
So if there's any indication out there, and I can speak about that, because I don't think it's secret anymore. There was a public information put out not 12 months ago, I think it was, and that would be from the Translation Bureau. And they were saying that the cost of spend has gone down substantially, but the number of words translated has 10x'd. And similarly, if you project that across the entire industry globally, you're absolutely right. The content to be translated is going up because tools are available to generate content now at a flick of a button.
And the awareness, people know that they have to enter markets. And whereas before, when you were talking, I mean, I helped Apple with the first worldwide release, right? Because I'm in the Bay Area, so I had a lot of technology clients doing marketing for them. And it was a big deal to get all the advertising ready for the same worldwide release, whereas worldwide releases happen every day now, you know? So I think that the market maturity has grown, the availability of solutions that are lower cost has grown. And I thought it was very interesting, your panel, moving on from Renato and staying on the CLIA topic, your panel on the status of the Canadian industry, right? And the fact that, why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because it was very early in the morning when I heard it.
So when I wanted to do the panel, you know, a lot of people have been, I've been involved in with the association, as many of you guys know out there, for over two decades now, 26 years, I think. And so I've seen this association go from various stages of our association here in Canada. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the Canadian Language Industry Association, for those of you who don't know, this is an association of language companies. So it's almost like ALC in the US, you know, Association of Language Companies. Now in Canada, it's similarly Canadian Language Industry Association. There are various levels of membership. People can participate in any way they want, but essentially it is a language company association. So that's one thing. The second thing is we wanted to address in the panel is for many people, like, and we have a few people on the board at the time who volunteered to be on the panel, that they have some history there. So they've been around for a while, and we wanted to share how did we get started, where did we come from, and where we're going in terms of our industry in Canada. Now, as everybody, and I had a call just before this podcast about globalization, as everybody knows, the pivot that Canada's taking, and you know, the Canadian language industry, for those of you from outside of Canada, you probably know by now, it's attached to the hip of the government. So if you did not know that, you saw that in the CLIA, you saw who the representations, et cetera, with all of our friends and colleagues from the federal government. We're almost
because there's a strong mandate that you have to be bilingual in your communication.
100%. So the pivot that we're going to be taking, that's what we talked about. And the question was being tossed around. Can Canada, the know-how, the intellectual properties that we've built over the years in Canada, the processes that we build in a bilingual country, can that learning be turned into a global event? Can we pivot it globally? And for instance, can Canada become the center of, for instance, AI for the language industry in Canada? Just from a regulated point of view, you know, security point of view, putting things behind firewalls, et cetera. Can Canada become, and this is the thing that we've been trying to resolve or to discuss for many years. So.
And you were able to have Michael Mullay on your panel, right?
Sorry, who?
Mike Mullay, the guy who used to work for the State Department, I think.
Yes, Mike was there too, and he's now a resident of Ottawa. He was in.
Yeah, we have a little bit of a brain drain going on. So
yeah, so it was good to have Mike on the panel as well. Now Andre was on the panel, which now he's the president. I heard. I got a text from somebody yesterday.
Yeah, he is.
He is the president. Actually, he texted me. I still owe him a message. I haven't gotten a chance to do it yet.
He was very good. I think he has a very nice positioning for the industry in general. And I think he was a guiding light for the CLIA schedule, which I thought was really very interesting. The caliber of speakers was excellent, not to tout my own horn. But, you know, I had a panel that was fabulous. And right after your panel, I think we heard from the purchasers, right? So we had a fantastic panel of people who buy translation services.
That's right. Bank of Montreal and a few others as well were on the phone too. So
yeah, very illustrious panelists. And they were very candid, I thought, in telling us that what they're looking for is exactly what Renato was talking about, right? They're looking for a partner who's going to navigate with them the AI mountain, who's going to help them produce attention to their customers in their languages with the least friction possible, right?
So, you know, there was a question being tossed around. I don't know. I'd like to get your opinion on it. You know, we've talked about Canada becoming the AI ecosystem for the world. I don't know if this is winnable, to be honest with you, or is it aspirational? It's a good thing to shoot for, but how
long? Well, I mean, given the experience of Canada, I mean, the thing about Canada that has always been true about your market is that in terms of professionalism and taking care of the linguists, right, and sort of maintaining a high remuneration for the work, you know, it was always like Chinese is going to subsidize the French Canadian. You know, one of the things that we know is true that could be working against you in your question, Robin, is that people, the buyers that were at this panel and buyers that I talk to of translation all the time, even before I sold my company, they can't afford to buy from a single language vendor. Right. I mean, if you're going to be IBM and you're going to do, I don't know why I picked that old name, but anyway, if you're going to be a big company and you're going to do a 35 language campaign, you're not going to hire 35 individual linguists as you might have done in the 90s. Right. So the fact that you need to merge up with people who can do other languages, or I was talking to somebody whose name used to be, I think, Southeast Asia, but now they do all languages. Right. So that's all growing as well. But the thing about the Canadian market is that it's supported by the government, which makes it somewhat impenetrable from people from the outside, but it also makes it the highest costing language pair, right? And as a result of that, I think that you guys have a lot of lessons to teach everyone, because as we all know, one of the big problems in the industry is that AI is out there telling you that you don't need a translator anymore. And meanwhile, we're dying for interpreters and translators, right? Yeah. So it's one of those incongruencies. And I think that Canada could take that, especially if you could have some government support in creating that and centralizing that and starting to command that kind of attention. I mean, only Switzerland, I think, would maybe be positioned better because of its requirements, right? Now, other countries, like, I would be interested, actually. Maybe you can do another podcast on this to find out what happens under the Russian countries, right? But I assume they also must have, like, in Kazakhstan, but they don't care that much about access, I guess. But yeah, they must have some good policies for being a duolingual or bilingual country, and that expertise based on your panel, I think, can definitely be a positive, and I would pursue it if I were.
No, one, I don't know, sure you caught that one, but Michael Miles raised a sort of a policy gap, as you know, and as the audience knows, you know, the predominant languages officially by the government is English and French, plus few Aboriginal languages, what got added in the past few years. But generally speaking, when a Canadian come to Canada or a potential Canadian come to Canada, an immigrant come to Canada, they have to learn English or French. So Michael was talking about the, you know, those demographics that they represented here in the country. And there's, you know, city like Toronto, they launched an RFP not too long ago for translation services, had almost 100 languages in it. So this is how many demographics are represented in the country, or, you know, in a city which is represented in the country. 15 million people live around here. So that's almost 40% of the population of the country.
Because there's no war against access going on in Canada, it's really nice to know that.
Michael's point was around, okay, so if you're asking, you know, a Chinese person to speak English or French, they don't. But they, meanwhile, they need to go to the government and get some services. And, you know, you talk to them in English, you're talking to them in French, and they don't understand you. So what is the policy around that? How do we bring that person into the space where we can understand them now? So it's still a question out there, but I thought it was interesting that he's, you know, he observed that. Because in the U.S., before that whole Canada, the United States is an English speaking country, there are many states with policies that you have to provide.
And we still have an Office of Civil Rights, and the language access policies are still there, and the states are pursuing those language access policies. But yes, I caught that Michael said that, but I found it a little bit hard to believe because of this Toronto RFP and the fact that I always found Canada to be very accommodating for the languages. I never knew it to be just exclusionary to your two primary languages. In fact, I think that I saw some stuff from Vancouver that was definitely catering to Chinese and in Hindi and Punjabi and those languages, right? So, but that's interesting because they probably also have to have those into French. So, wow, that is really a can of worms.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying, like, there are services that the government provides currently English or French that some people don't understand them. And that's why you talk to some of the companies that we did not really get. I'm not sure if you had a chance to meet some of the companies here are on the interpretation side. You know, Lola, it runs one, by the way. You met Lola, right?
I love Lola.
Peter runs a, well, actually, he just stepped out of that one. He runs another one, which provides, you know, that whole community interpreters, legal interpretation, healthcare related interpretation, etc. So there are a few of those companies popping up here and there to help these communities, I guess. No.
And so did you guys come up with a way that maybe you guys could bring this up as an initiative to kind
of... Well, there is an advocacy group. I don't know if it's that's the point. I'm supposed to be saying advocacy group where they have a different status. I thought they were an advocacy group. It's called the Language Access Canada. And they're supposed to be pushing for various demographics to have, you know, recognized language access, not just English or French.
I mean, yeah, we started, stuff, you know,
on the metro, they don't know where they're going. The stuff is English. The writing is in English or French.
There's a little bit of work that has been done. I don't know if you're familiar with this movie Translators that was won some small awards. It's a documentary sponsored by the Bank of the U.S., I think, or something. And it basically glorifies children as interpreters, Robin. And so we started through the ALC an initiative to try to continue the education, which, by the way, CODA, the movie, is the very best education that you can have for why people need interpreters, right? It's such a fabulous movie. And I think it's Canadian, right?
I'm not familiar with this particular
movie. You're not familiar with CODA? Children of Deaf
Adults? Talk about the translators, I'm thinking like the interpreter, Nicole Kidman, but I don't know.
That one too. No. But so we definitely need to continue to raise awareness. I mean, even Trump said the other day that the interpreters are very important because they could misinterpret what he's saying to another leader or something.
You know,
so I think the awareness for the importance of translators is really important. And you could hear from the buyers panel, Robin, that there is a lot of awareness at companies that they have to service. You know, I have an anecdote that's super good for how to pivot from language access to ROI. One of my very first jobs back in the 80s was with Pacific Bell, the phone company that got broken up or whatever. And they got a mandate from Sacramento in California that they needed to put little disclaimers on the bill that there was language access available, right? And what they found out is that the biggest market that was making long distance calls were these foreign language markets, right? So within 2 months of doing this because of regulatory, it went over to marketing because of ROI. So if you ever caught in a situation where you're talking with a potential customer and they're doing it because they think they have to or because they have a regulation that they have to, there are many case studies now that show that the return on investment from a foreign language campaign can sometimes totally dwarf what you're doing in English, right? Because a lot of these markets are more loyal to a certain product and stuff like that.
You know, you just mentioned it earlier, the buyers panel, which is very interesting. I just posted a podcast this yesterday with Weda from Weda File. He used to work for Harley Davidson. And it's very interesting because I feel like we don't talk enough to buyers, to be honest with you, and I think we should. And we should bring them in more often to our conversation. There's a lot of learning there from the buyers themselves and what do they need? How do they react? What technology they prefer? How do they like to be sold to? This is, to a lot of people, still a mystery, right? And I was so encouraged to hear that, you know, when I saw the schedule, to hear like PepsiCo, Air Canada, Bank of Montreal.
Real, you know, clients, right?
Yeah, you know, they're going to be on the call. Like, they're going to be on the panel, which is, you know, most of them, like, they're all friends of mine, and I've been doing business with them for many years. But I just love to have them on the conversation, you know, instead of us.
Completely.
You know,
and another thing I think Renato said, and I hear often, is that so many people don't pick up their phone anymore, and we don't talk to the clients, even though you're supposed to. You know, the biggest advice we have right now is to grow your position from the translator to the advisor to the partner, right? But how do you get that seat at the table? And actually, M&A can be a very good way to open up those conversations, because most clients, if you just call them and say, hi, how are you? How come you haven't sent me any work? You know, they're not going to want to talk to you. But you call them and you say, hey, guess what? Now we offer interpretation and we just did this case study and you have news for them that is of interest to them. They're going to pick up the phone and they're going to give you maybe a lunch date again. And you can develop the relationship from there. So by growing your business through an association with another company, maybe you only provide translation, they only provide interpretation. You get together and now you can call your clients and say, guess what? For your community event, I now have a partner that does this interpreting, and it gives you subject matter to be able to open the door and talk to the customers, right? And in fact, I see that you and I just chatter away and we talk about all kinds of stuff. And so I'll bring us back to the CLIA program. And I think the next panel was...
That's part of the CLIA program, to be honest with you. That's exactly what we're talking about. It's the absolute thing that was covered. One of the things is on the buyer side that I'm, you know, it came out and it continuously comes out that our industry needs to take note of and write it down and basically practice it and make sure that we're understanding what that is connecting our services to business outcome. Everybody wants,
absolutely,
every one of our buyers wants to look good in front of their boss, and we have to enable that. And if we don't connect what we do to, and I heard that like just this week, if I see one more proposal that tells me I have translators in local countries or in regions, I'm going to flip out. Who doesn't? Just give me something new.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, and remember that as I was telling you about the mergers and acquisitions, when I started the ALC webinars on M&A, there was no one. And now there's five or six of us, you know, who are doing it. And if you don't have competition, you're in the wrong business, right? So part of the game is to figure out how you're going to rise above the competition, but encourage the competition, because if you're in an abundance mindset and you're in an abundance industry that is growing, then there's enough for everybody to grow and to invent new things in order to serve the customers eventually, right? But it is that cost of all of this that we're talking about that makes the idea of purchasing and growing through acquisition more attractive. I have to give a quick disclaimer whenever I say this, because people get excited and they call me and they're like, I want to start buying somebody. And the thing is that mergers and acquisitions, just like any part of your business, it's not easy, right? And in fact, the hardest part, and I mean, it's hard to find the right buyer. It's hard to find the right seller. It's hard to present the numbers in a way that they're going to buy from you. It's hard to make the right number. It's hard to do all of that, okay? But they say that the hardest part is the integration. So it's not easy, but it is fruitful, and a lot of people are having success with that. And I was very happy with our panel because we covered three continents. We had somebody in Europe from One Stop Asia. We had somebody in America, Peter Smith, who has made, you know, 6 to 8 acquisitions in the recent past. And then we had Bogan from Canada, who made a spectacular acquisition and is now has a very incredible formula for bringing in small companies. So it's important to mention that we really saw that the size, you know, maybe a year ago, people were only asking for $1 million plus sales in the companies that they were buying. But now they've come up with some formulations that lower their risk and allow the owners, if they still have energy, to keep selling or keep growing under the rubric of a bigger company. And just as a final point from what I got out of my panel, that I got a lot out of it because they were really spectacular guests, is that when you sell your company, I felt bad for this seller because he had gone from 500,000 to like 200,000 in sales. And he was very depressed, and he was a single language vendor, and they were offering like to buy 10% of, you know, give him 10% of whatever came in kind of deal. And I was feeling bad for him. And the buyer told me, don't feel bad. Maybe we're going to triple his sales, because when we go in and tell him you were only buying this language and now you can buy 30 languages, they're going to grow a lot. So 10% of a lot could be even more than what the guy was making. And so I got really excited because I like to help people.
Is there still a gap between what people are asking for or people are willing to pay?
Big gap. I mean, right now there's a lot of buyers and there's a lot of sellers because of the industry. But that gap between what the buyers want to pay and what the sellers are willing to take is huge. So a lot of people are investigating.
It's challenging for you to bring them back to a realistic picture.
It's their baby, right? So, you know, you can only say so much. But this realization that you could have, you know, $200,000 of one language, but let's say that that customer now buys $1 million instead of $200,000, 10% of $1 million is a lot more than you were making once you take all your expenses of 200,000, right?
Does it feel to you the industry growing or retracting based on what you're seeing out there?
There's definitely consolidation going on and escalating the business to be something more than a translation company. Okay. So there's people like Datamundi who grew tremendously through data services, right? And so one area is data services and one area is language services, right? And so I think that the industry is still growing, as Renato said. I think that there's a lot of consolidation because of the position the buyers are in, that they don't want to buy. You know, it used to be that you wanted boutiques, right? Because you wanted to get the right cadence, the right localization, all that kind of stuff. But now things move so quickly and the synchronous releases and all this kind of stuff that doing it single language is just not going to cut it for the big buyers, right? So the market is dynamic, it's changing, but the opportunity still exists and I think it's still growing.
What do you think of the idea that Joaquin brought up, the human plus machine is the winning formula versus either or, machine alone or human alone?
That's great that you moved on, because otherwise we'll stay forever on the earlier topics. But the later topics at CLIA were very spot on the AI issue, right? I mean, they had very specific ideas of what AI can do and everything like that. And what I'm afraid of personally with AI is that the bad data, the lack of ability to discern good data from bad data, and the fact that a lot of people are putting a lot of bad data out there, it might make the whole thing unusable. I mean, a lot of people who decided to go the AI route are retrenching.
They're not sanitizing their data.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't answer your question because of the big retrenching that I foresee. I think that there will be a retrenching once people go full bore into it and they find out that they can't get there from here. So, and all that bad data, I just don't know who's going to clean up the data. It's going to become a little bit like the algae in the ocean, Robin.
Yeah.
You're going to be having cleaners of that data like every day. And we can't even establish any kind of like truth in advertising. All of the truth meters and stuff seem to be escaping our current universe, right? And so the ability to do that. So the idea that you're going to have AI without a human in the loop, I think, is ludicrous.
Well, I mean, it won't be for every task, that's for sure.
No.
Some tasks. And that's what I've been talking about for, I don't know, 15 years here, is before AI became what it is right now, is to be able to take a look at the processes and figure out which process can I automate, which process I need to still have a human involved. But what people
tend
to
do people
is broad brush stroke, basically. I'm going to put AI in. Well, hang on a second. You got to take a look at your processes first and figure out where AI fits.
Absolutely. And that consultancy role is where we need to fit in, right? We can't close our eyes and say, no, AI is terrible. It's going to make mistakes.
That's right.
Because there are definitely use cases that are low cost. And when TMs came out, this was exactly the point of, I forget who it was. I think it was TripAdvisor or one of these companies who spent a lot of money optimizing their LNF in order to be able to provide really good translations. And, you know, nobody's going to die if the restaurant review came out wrong, Robin.
That's right.
You know, so yeah. There are definitely use cases where it's more helpful.
Bad meal or something, but that's not going to kill anybody.
I mean, the thing that we used to always say is find out the purpose of it, you know, because sometimes a low threshold localization by Google Translate can be enough for what you're trying to accomplish, right? And so I think that's Renato's point. And I think that was also evident in the AI panels, that if you understand the purpose of your work, if you understand what you're trying to accomplish with it, there might be tools that you can train where they're going to achieve a 95% accuracy, right? And if they don't, it doesn't really matter. But we used to say before there was AI and all of this technology that it depends on how much the user wants the information. And I used to give the example in my presentations that if you're a cancer patient and they discovered this incredible cure in Mongolia and there's no translation for it, you're going to struggle with Google Translate because you really want that information, right? But as a marketing point, nobody really wants your information. If you're going to be stuffing information down their throat, you better be accurate, you better be cute, you better be localized, right? You're not going to get them to read an ad that says a goat instead of a...
Now, on that same topic, I feel like a lot of people are a bit managing, I think, the 20% that doesn't work, and they throw the baby with the bathwater kind of thing. So one of the things that we're talking about here, and I actually had a very interesting conversation yesterday with somebody from outside the industry. They have a company. It's an AI agentic development company, and their view on it. You know, the layer that we have in, you got a data, and that's not me saying that, that's the CEO of Microsoft saying it. We have data and we have a software layer, we call the SaaS software, on top of that to access the data. The new feature right now, or not a new feature, the new generation of programming is we're going to get the agentic AI direct access to data. So removing the SaaS layer out. Now it's going to take time. It's not happening. People don't freak out. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but that's the idea. What it means is that entire SaaS layer goes away. If the agentic direct access to AI, sorry, to data, to databases works.
You're successful.
Currently, I worked in the database world for many, many years, back when I was in the tech side, and I worked on data DB2 on IBMs for all my life almost, and did in the SQL programming, did all that stuff. So the querying of the data currently is done through an interface outside. So we have, I don't know, we have a CRM, we have TMSs, and they're accessing the data. The idea is two things. One is, can I use AI to manage the interfaces for those TMSs, et cetera. So instead of somebody keying in the data inside the TMS, now I can use an agentic AI to make sure that the data is placed in the same place. And be honest with you, people can be used for better use for those people instead of keystrokes and how many you type per minute, et cetera.
Sure. And if you build enough checks that it's actually going into the right place, then maybe you might be okay, right?
But a lot of people inside the process. Now you're on the outside watching the process and just taking the imperfection and fixing them and put them back in.
The thing is that, you know, one of the other fears that I have is that I was at Lockworld, I think, or at SlaterCon in Silicon Valley, and there was a booth for Unicode, Ron. And I was like, oh, a booth for Unicode, that's really cute. Did you guys make a new code page? Why are you guys here? And they said, oh no, you wouldn't believe it, but everybody's doing their own coding and everything, and they forgot that there was Unicode. So the whole reason why Unicode is out there now is just to remind them that there's Unicode. But imagine all these people who are creating software now. That Citrini article that made the software stocks all fall down, right, was amazing. But in the meantime, they're not going to work, Robin. And these people need 100% reliability. I mean, look at what they were asking for us from in the 90s, right? And now they're willing to throw it all away and not even be able to represent Japanese characters because they don't understand that there's Unicode. I mean, it's just stunning.
You know, I think Eliza said it, right? I think on the panel there, I think it was Eliza who said, I'm not going to repeat the word, but she said AI is like a free adrenaline, free drug now for people. And, you know, when they take a sip of that, they feel like so sharp, so invigorated, but they're really missing the point. I was talking about it this morning. Because you can code, because you can develop an application out there, you're not a software engineer. You're not an architect. You're not a designer. And if you don't do it right, that's going to be the gateway to open cybersecurity issues.
And that's what I'm afraid of, because people didn't even know there was Unicode. I mean, this is the example that I have to give to people. For those of you who are listening who don't know what Unicode is, in the 80s, the whole world got together and they created, I don't know, a billion set characters so that you could see Japanese characters and Hindi characters, and everybody could just put three keystrokes in their keyboard and come up with a character that was the same character that they were going to come up with Japan. When I first started, you were either ShiftGIS or I forget what the other code pages that there were. But like you could get a document from a translator and you wouldn't be able to see it, Robin. You wouldn't be able to read it. I mean, these were problems that we solved, like measles and polio, right? But I mean, people just forget. And there's a big push to lower expertise and to lower the threshold and just say, why should I pay you when I can just do it myself? Well, you can't, because when you take it out for a test drive, your whole data is going to crash and you're going to have a data breach. And, you know, I mean, how is HIPAA even a factor when you're uploading all the data, right? I mean, it's really the lack of expertise is problematic. So just a few minutes ago, I told you positively, and I was positively encouraged by the two AI panels, because it seems like maybe governance is coming back into the euphoria of AI. So, and I always use negative selling, like the don't get pregnant with your clients, right? So scare the hell out of the people who want to just bypass any expertise.
Yeah, it's FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. You know, I mean, just to give you an example for the audience, what we're talking about, For the past couple of days, I've written an application for the Fireside Chat, which you guys will see here soon. You're going to be able to download the app, put it on your phone, where you can have all of our content in a single location, audio, video, and text. You're able to search, you're able to go back into archive and look at our podcasts, et cetera. So building the app literally took me, I don't know, a few hours. Building the security wrapper around it, probably I'll spend 4 days doing that. So I'm not done yet.
To do that, and so many people will go to market with something that is full of holes, and the buyers won't even know to look for the holes, right? So it's scary, but there's also opportunity there, because the more disasters that we become aware of, the more that there's going to be a need for that. And going back to my song is that if you don't have a technology partner, maybe that's the merger that
and
you
people
want.
Need to be trained, Carla. Like I'm noticing like not enough education on the topic. So, you know, I feel people like they're like, the company just bought us access to Claude, okay? Or sorry, another CRM from some sort. Okay, did they give you training?
Well, it's early days, Robin. I mean, did you hear the story that all these big companies gave everybody big encouragement and they gave them free token access, and then they blew through their tokens like in the first 3 months for the year. And so all of a sudden, the new director from the C-suite is like, you can't use it to plan your dinner and you can't. So it's very early days, and we are still going. I hope that nobody gets to be the one who gets the flaw, right? Another really old story from my Pacific Bell days is that the very first job they got me consulting with them on, it was the very first Yellow Pages that they put out with headers in Korean and English for Korean town down in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And it was still when we used to strip type, and the stripper put all the Korean characters upside down. So they printed like over 1 million books with all the Korean characters upside down. So coming in to clean that up was a lot of fun. Being the one who made the mistake was not fun at all. You know? Wow. So I hope nobody who's listening to this is the one who makes the AI mistakes, but there's going to be a big opportunity for AI cleanup. And one thing I learned from my clients is that once they've been burnt, they become really good clients. So durability, hanging in there, and knowing when to come to the rescue, having that relationship and calling your clients. If they got rid of you because they got AI, you know, wait 3 months and call them and
stay in touch. Don't give up. Stay in touch.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. And so coming back to the CLIA, I thought that the panel on what you need to do, you know, the thing that came at the close was very, very insightful, right? And so basically they say, don't optimize a dying model, start building one that will replace that.
Is that
think
the
about what are
Netflix?
The real...
Did you catch that one? Blockbuster versus... That,
the Netflix, that's the one that I was going to say. Yeah, why don't you tell us a brief about that? Because it was such a good example, right? That Netflix thought that they could... Sorry, Blockbuster thought that they could wait out Netflix, right?
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Netflix invented a totally new model. And sure, it took about 10 years for all the Blockbusters to leave, right? But they realized it way too late, so... What the panelists told us in very effective terms is be a Netflix, don't be a Blockbuster.
No, one of the things that on that panel, Carla, I'm not sure if you noticed, because it's a topic on everybody's mind, is how we price translation, right? So the old per word.
That was very interesting.
Per word pricing model is pretty much done when you introduce AI that handles 80 to 90% of the output. And I think there was a discussion on the panel, which I think I took some note of it, was when says somebody floated the idea of a retainer, some other people, you know, outcome-based pricing, and people still struggling to quantify these things. But some other people, like they talked about flat monthly fees, for instance. The expertise and putting a dollar figure around the expertise, you know, the companies becomes consultants now. Like you have to think as a consultant. You're the one
and a lot of us, you know, especially the old ones of us who started as linguists and put one foot in front of the other instead of going to business, coming up with those business models is challenging. And what I would say to that is that, again, with the customer, it's the best idea, right? Your customers, okay, so when I think about my customers when I had international contact, right? Those customers, they're just mediators for somebody else in their company, right? They're feeling all these pressures as well. So your job is to find out what of those pressures that they have you can alleviate so that you become a partner in their enterprise. And the one that they're going to think of calling is you when it's time to decide what to do to break. And they won't move without you because you're the holder of that expertise. But it does mean escalating yourself up higher in the food chain. And the way in is by talking to your customers, by understanding their challenges and what they're trying to impress their boss with, right? What their mission is and how you can help that mission. The truth is that the need for localization has never been bigger with worldwide companies who need to do everything on a reduced budget and in 100 languages, right? So you just need to be able to get in there with that information. Today, I got a thing from SmartLing saying about how much cheaper translation is now, right? So somebody big like SmartLing can attack it from that perspective. But that's always a great hook. And so if you're sitting there saying like, no, you need to only have linguists and you only need to have a TP and you only need to do this while your customers are out buying other things, then you're probably
going
to be blockbuster. I mean, they can only stay with you so long if you can get a download versus having to go to the store, right? I mean, that's why the blockbuster Netflix analogy is so powerful, is because it's so clear that they were just left behind and customers didn't want that anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the Kodak. No longer. Nobody hears from Kodak anymore.
Exactly. Exactly.
The other thing too is that,
Go ahead. No, I mean, basically, I was just going to say that Kodak has shrunk tremendously, but they keep trying to come back with different things, recognizing the assets that they have and how they can pivot in order to be more relevant, right?
You know, on the blockbuster Netflix, I'm reminded by a conversation I've had with, who was she? Veronica Hylek, when she contradicted the point that Silicon Valley brought up. That's your neighborhood, Carla. They said, we've solved the language problem. What's next?
Right.
And I remember clearly having that debate with Veronica. Veronica was completely against it. And no, hang on a second. You haven't solved anything yet. We've solved some parts, fine. But there are the intellectual part, the nuances, the culture, all that stuff hasn't been captured yet. It's not in any model. And to put it into a model, it's not possible. There's a huge amount of, unless you're starting to feel through the words as a technology built from chips and et cetera, microchips, et cetera, you're not going to be able to do it. You're not going to be able to capture the human emotion.
Well, and they're not doing real creativity, right? I mean, it's a different function. And that's what's becoming clear now, is that the AI is really a computer. It's a data, it's able to predict the next action, right? But it's never going to come up with something. Well, it's starting to come up. I don't know, never. I mean, I'm not a technologist, so I can't really tell you. But yeah. I think that the chances for corruption and for lack of performance. And I mean, the one thing that was so important to all of our clients was that consistency of output, right? I mean, they needed to know sleep better. We're tying it back to sleep better at night, right? They needed to know that they were not going to go out and put a goat instead of saying greatest of all time, right? I mean, they need to know that before they feel confident. And yet so many of them are like riding roadshod and going out to the wild, wild west, throwing out things. I'm reminded, one last analogy that I can give you that was super funny, is that this one very creative language company put up a portal with a dictionary translation for their customers because the C-suite was demanding AI, AI, AI. And so they put up this thing where they could have free translation with this little thing, and nobody ever uses it, but now they think they have it. So, sometimes illusions are not the real thing, and we have to persist. And I think, one of the bad things about having the conference be virtual, Robin, is that not only was I not able to see it at 5 a.m., but by the time the closing session came, I was distracted with daytime activities here at my desk, and I didn't see the closing session, and we don't have a recording of it. So did you see it? What did I miss?
Day. You got to continue your workday, right?
Yeah. But the thing is that I missed what Peter and what they said at the end. But I thought that it was a very comprehensive look at the current status of the industry.
Yep.
What small agencies can do to be more competitive, to be more agile. And it covered pretty much all the areas that I could think of that, and I've encouraged Clea to sell passes after the fact, Robin. So hopefully by the time you publish this, we'll have a way for people to watch those great sessions, because I thought they were.
I did publish my panel, and I did publish my panel. I think I published the panel that I was on. No, I did not publish, but because I don't own the right for that one. Clea does.
No, no, you published your chat. You had a local fireside chat and you published
during lunch.
But hopefully this has been helpful to everyone for hearing a little bit of what went on. Clea has some very exciting programs. My panel, for example, was just the buyers talking about what they're looking for and their growth by acquisition strategies. But we're going to have a webinar in October for Clea on how to prepare your agency for sale and some of the technical details of that. So stay in touch with Clea. And definitely, I love chatting with you, Robin.
Same here.
And it was such a great event. You know, I really got a lot out of it.
So hopefully we'll do this again. And I know you and I were going to be talking again, but hopefully we do the event again.
Yeah, let's do some event recaps of any events that we can do. I really think we're good together, and I hope people agree. Please leave us a comment and let us know if you got this far.
Before we wrap it up, if you don't mind, Carla, if somebody's interested in reaching out to you to talk about what you do.
I mind that very much.
No, I was just going to ask them, how do they find you?
I'm on LinkedIn, and my email is carla@exitforesight.com.
Absolutely.
And I look forward to hearing from everyone. I want to help you have an exit strategy and find a way to grow fast through M&A. Robin, it's been a real pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity very much. And I can't wait till the next one.
Absolutely. For the audience, you can tell the energy and the passion that we both have here on this topic, right? You can see the back and forth and the chemistry on this one. So expect another episode after this one, right? So we're going to publish this one, but Carla and I, we're going to do another podcast this time hosted by Carla. I'll be the guest. And we'll have another.
And you can interrupt me as much as I interrupted you.
No, that's part of the job. That's okay.
Thanks so much. And we'll see everybody around. Let us know if you like it so we can give you more.
Absolutely. And for the audience, thanks so much for joining me on this conversation, on this recording. If you're joining us on YouTube, thanks for watching. And if you're joining us on the audio channel, thanks for listening in. And if you're reading the blog where I summarize these conversations in an archivable form, thank you for watching the blog and reading it and sharing it with others. And from me and Carla, we want to thank you for listening in to us today. And hopefully we'll see you at the next episode. Thanks, everybody. See you later.
Take care.